broadcasting from the Gulag city of Planet Earth. This is Cultural Baggage. My name is Dean Becker. Our engineer is Steve Nolan. And in a few moments, we'll bring in our guest for the evening, the author of Understanding Marijuana, A New Look at the Scientific Evidence, Dr. Mitch Earlywine. But first, the news. This story comes to us today. Indicates that a gentleman named LaShawn Banks was taking a shower when masked and heavily armed officers broke into his Las Vegas apartment in 1998 looking for drugs. The Supreme Court today used his case to clarify how long police must wait before breaking into a home to serve a warrant. The court ruled 9-0 that if police had waited any longer than 20 seconds, a drug suspect could be flushing evidence down the toilet. Last week, District Judge Howard Matz sentenced three members of the now defunct Los Angeles Cannabis Buyers Resource Club to just a year's probation for selling medical marijuana to AIDS and cancer sufferers. More significant than the sentences were the judge's remarks. Quote, to allocate the resources of the Drug Enforcement Agency and the U.S. Attorney's Office in this case baffles me. Disturbs me. End quote. The men had been arrested after a federal raid on the center in October 2001, just a month after an event that one might have imagined was marginally more worthy of the FBI's energies. This from the Guardian newspaper out of Great Britain. Drug use by prisoners hits 80%. Drugs charities have called for more treatment programs in jails and in the community after the head of the prison service admitted that up to 80% of new prisoners were hard drug users. The director general of the prison service, Phil Wheatley, said 55% of people entering prison were classified as problematic users of illegal drugs, including cannabis, with another 25% reporting some drug misuse. He told the Independent newspaper that the problem was even more acute in some urban jails where 80% of new arrivals were found to have taken Class A drugs such as heroin in the past 48 hours.
On November 28, 2003, the New York Times published the following letter to the editor. We are medical and psychological researchers who are concerned about your use of the term crack baby. During years of studying addictions and prenatal exposure to psychoactive substances, none of us have ever identified a recognizable condition, syndrome, or disorder that could be termed crack baby. Some of our published research finds subtle effects of prenatal cocaine exposure in select developmental domains, while other of our research publications do not. Crack baby is not a medical diagnosis, but a media stereotype. Such pejorative stigmatization of children is not only scientifically inaccurate, but also dangerous. An October 28th news article illustrates how this stereotype delays interventions. While a New Jersey family apparently starved several of their adopted children, representing to neighbors and professionals that the four boys had been born addicted to crack cocaine. This letter was signed by 27 American and Canadian researchers, as well as by Deborah A. Frank, M.D., professor of pediatrics at Boston University School of Medicine.
And I'm one of a number of researchers funded by the National Institute on Drug Abuse who got together to write this letter. It was in response to a story in the New York Times where adopted children were starved, and although everyone saw them starving, the family that was starving them simply said, oh, they're crack babies, and people simply let them starve. And those of us, and there were like 28 signers of the letter who've been researching this field for a long time, were appalled because in all our research we have never found any syndrome, diagnosis, or condition that should be called crack baby, that were blown way out of proportion. And then people started saying, even scientists started saying crazy things like, these children are missing what makes us human, and all sorts of, you know, truly bizarre things that you would never say about, you know, a child in general.
In honor of Dr. Deborah A. Frank and the 27 other American and Canadian signatories to this letter, we named them the Drug War Heroes of the Week.
Okay, without any further ado, let's go ahead and bring in our guest for the evening, the author of Understanding Marijuana, A New Look at the Scientific Evidence, Dr. Mitch Earlywine. Are you there? Dr. Earlywine.
I'm right here.
Hello, sir. How are you this evening?
Oh, great.
Great. Yeah, good to have you with us. If you would, tell the folks a little bit about who you are and the work you do.
Sure thing. I'm Associate Professor of Psychology at the University of Southern California, and I have grants from the National Institutes of Health to study alcohol's impact on aggression, and I'm also the author of Understanding Marijuana, where I reviewed about 5,000 different studies on cannabis that have been conducted over the last couple hundred years.
Well, thank you, sir. I've had the good fortune of reading your book, and I want to tell folks, if you want a better understanding of this, there's no better outlook at this complex situation of marijuana. It's not as simple as some would claim, nor as complex as others would claim. Where is the balance in regards to marijuana?
I'm finding that a lot of the things that we all may have learned in junior high and health class clearly aren't true. So this idea that cannabis creates an amotivational syndrome or is a gateway to harder drugs or would make users aggressive, those three ideas are pretty clearly false. However, some other things that folks who are big advocates of cannabis assert also aren't necessarily true either. So there does seem to be a subset of folks who develop problems with marijuana if they're daily users. It's not completely harmless, but it's certainly not as harmless as we were led to believe in our health classes in junior high.
And that brings to mind, I don't know, I'm hoping you heard the story I did with Dr. Frank about the crack babies.
Yes, sure.
And it's my contention that if it's not fraud, there's just a lot of bad science involved in the investigation of these drugs. Am I correct in that assumption?
I think that's absolutely the case. And what happens, too, is somebody makes a really small finding or suggests a really minor negative consequence to any of these drugs, and the media often gets a hold of that and blows it up and ignores some of the caveats that scientists actually suggest in the original scientific papers.
Right. That recent, I'll call it a fiasco, at Johns Hopkins regarding MDMA, I think, is another prime and, great example.
That's by far an outlier. I would hate to think that there are very many studies as false as that one. But there are definitely things where, for example, an investigator might run 100 tests on somebody, some folks who used cannabis and others who did not, and find two just by chance where they did differ. And unfortunately, they don't report the other 98. Well, that's clearly going to be a problem.
Right. Now, insofar as, marijuana, I mean, if all the rumors, if you will, through the years were true, I would have breasts as large as, a charo or something.
Gynecomastia, as it's called, this notion that cannabis would get men to grow breasts is just absolutely, completely fallacious. I don't know where that started, but right around the Reefer Madness time, in the late 30s, suddenly this was something that was attributed to cannabis. And boy, it's funny how once these things get started, they never seem to die.
Well, some of them have begun to die off, I think, like the original drug czar Anslinger's contention that it led to insanity, criminality, and death. I mean, I think we've disproven a couple of those.
Thank goodness, yes. I find there is no toxic dose of cannabis as far as lethality is concerned. Nobody's ever died from an overdose of cannabis, and I do feel like even the current drug czar understands that. And yes, you're absolutely right. The links to criminality are completely spurious. There may be some criminals who like to smoke cannabis, but smoking cannabis certainly doesn't make anyone a criminal.
Right, and and looking through your book, I see where, as you mentioned earlier, you've looked at these studies dating back to as far back as, 8,000 years?
Well, the studies weren't actually that old, but there's some references to hemp used industrially back that far, and it suggests that industrial hemp has quite the history for us all, and really is something we ought to open up to, especially here in this country where we could be saving a whole lot of money and a whole lot of ecological troubles if we would turn to hemp as a nice biodegradable substitute for some of our plastics and cloth and things like that.
And fuel, even, in some cases. Now,
absolutely.
We have so many farmers that, you hear about the big industrial conglomerates are taking over the farm belts and so forth because these farmers are unable to make a profit, selling corn against, these larger companies. And I've heard it said that, there's 20,000 uses for hemp. Would you name a few more of them?
I'd be happy to. One of the most prominent ones is just that it's edible. Both the oil and the seeds are extremely good sources of protein, a lot of amino acids that we don't normally get in other sources, and obviously it's a vegetarian source of these things, and that does superbly well. The use as fuel, the oil seems to burn as fuel extremely efficiently and extremely well. The use as paper could save us literally, you know, hundreds and hundreds of acres of wooded areas, because the paper really is easy to make and doesn't require some of the same chemical processing that turning wood pulp into paper requires. So it would be ecologically incredibly sound. And the medical uses are obvious, but we're accustomed to that from the medical cannabis discussions. And hemp is just a wonderful textile. So I've got a hemp shirt on right now, actually, that's extremely comfortable, and it's a cotton blend and wears very well. And it's really a nice, convenient, easy thing to do.
You know, there are, you look back through history, the colonization, if you will, of the Americas, and how they came to this country and mandated that people change their religion, change their sacraments, change their whole way of life in order to Europeanize them. Would you talk on that subject, please?
As it turns out, when you see how cannabis sort of spread, it really had a whole lot of that going on, and then this kind of resistance to something because it's foreign is very stereotypical of our sort of view of Western European society. But the idea was essentially that there were acceptable sacraments and there were some that were not. So as cannabis seemed to have started sort of in Taiwan and spread around there, primarily for medicinal uses, but also hemp as a fiber, and then sort of went through Asia and into Africa, where it looks like smoking probably began. And it seems like by the time things were in Egypt and Napoleon was coming down and his armies tended to bring some of the hashish back up to them, and the French got a hold of that and seemed to really enjoy it, but of course then the church thought it was really evil. It's sort of our stereotypical reaction to anything that's foreign.
Oh, so true. I'm looking at kind of an inquisitory bill that they're perhaps going to pass in Kentucky. And I'm going to quote from it here. The bill would allow family members, friends, or anyone else for that matter to petition a Kentucky court seeking the involuntary commitment of a, quote, drug abuser. And I just wanted to get your thoughts on that. Are we putting too many people in treatment?
Yeah, I really am reluctant to say that anybody should be forced into treatment. And I think our models of treatment have been so myopic in that it's this one size fits all, absolute abstinence is the only solution, and that's just clearly not true, and it doesn't fit the experience of folks who've had drug problems and recovered spontaneously, and here we are lost in this idea that we're going to somehow essentially turn treatment into prison, turn it into a thing that is basically a punishment instead of an opportunity to help folks who are eager for help.
Right, right. They say you can get over an addiction, but you can't get over a conviction.
Exactly.
All right, Dr. Earlywine, if you will give us just one moment here, we're going to take a little break, and we'll be right back.
Super.
For 8,000 years, marijuana has been known as a wonderful relaxant for bedtime. It's time to play Name That Drug by its side effects. Memory loss, falling asleep while driving, fainting spells, confusion, depression, slurred speech, agitation, hangovers, strange dreams, and hallucinations. Time's up. The answer, Ambien for sleep disorders.
This is Mark Greer, Executive Director of Drug Sense. You're listening to Cultural Baggage. To end the drug war, visit MAPINC.org. That's MAPINC.org. Get active, stay aware, stay informed, and let's bring an end to this nonsense.
All right, Dr. Earlywine, you are listening to Cultural Baggage, and our guest for the evening is Dr. Mitch Earlywine, the author of Understanding Marijuana, A New Look at the Scientific Evidence. Dr. Earlywine, there have been, I've heard people say, $500 billion spent. We've put tens of millions of our own citizens in jail. Do you see any progress, any mechanism whereby we can move away from this vendetta against our own people?
I'm cautiously optimistic, Dean, and maybe it's naive of me, but when I see things like you just reported with Scott Imler and how suddenly judges are saying, this is not the way I want the DEA, law enforcement officers, et cetera, to spend their time, suddenly it's going to dawn on us that just financially, this is not the way to go. This is not the best use of time for our police officers. This is not the best use of time for our court systems. And it's certainly a complete waste of time for our prison systems. Let's let this go. Let's let this go. And I think the first step may be simple decriminalization of cannabis on a state-by-state basis. California has already saved over $1 billion, a billion, by altering its basically criminalization of cannabis. And slowly but surely, other states are starting to see that this is going to affect the bottom line. Regardless of how you feel about intoxication or how you feel about drug-related problems, it's just financially sensible to let cannabis be decriminalized. And when I think about it from a moral standpoint, the shoe really has to be on the foot of the people who are going to offer punishment. It's not why should cannabis be decriminalized, it's why should somebody go to jail for owning a plant? And I feel like they're the ones who need to make the case, not the folks who are saying, gee, this freedom is what belongs to us. It's the people who are saying we should punish people for owning this plant that should have to make the argument.
I wholeheartedly agree with you. I mean, I began my work as a reformer as a Sacramento cannabis, you know, advocate. Genesis chapter 1, verse 11 through 13. We have
all
dominion.
Right there.
We have dominion over that plant. And I don't know where these guys got the idea. They do. They wanted to take a plant and turn it into a national security issue somehow.
Well, and what's funny is, getting back to the hemp issue, now people are scared that if farmers grow hemp, that somehow in between the hemp rows they're going to grow psychoactive cannabis. And if you know anything about raising psychoactive cannabis, you know that would be an absolute absurdity, because the big, long, tall stalks of hemp would basically cross-pollinate and contaminate the psychoactive cannabis. So it's as if we're so afraid of THC that we can't even let something that looks like the same plant end up saving us tons and tons of money and ecological advantages, because we're just so frightened.
Now, if I may reach back a few minutes, I was discussing the fact that, you know, 500 years ago we tried to change the cultures of the Americas,
mm-hmm.
and so forth. And in conjunction with that, through our black market, the prohibition of drugs, we've taken this situation where, like you say, it's just a plant, becomes suddenly worth more than gold. And the price markups, my guest a couple weeks back, Jack Cole, said it's 17,000% on opium by the time it makes it to the nickel bag in New York. And yet these drug companies, Claritin, it escalates 30,000%. I look here at the big one. Xanax is 570,000% markup these guys do from the cost of the material. I guess my question centers around, it is just greed that runs either side of this equation in the drug war.
I'm afraid that's really the case, and it's flabbergasting when you sit down and think, how much would it really cost to grow a plant in your backyard and have enough for a joint? And the University of Mississippi, where they have the one sort of legal place to grow medical cannabis, those guys usually say between 75 cents and a dollar for a joint.
Yeah.
If you can imagine, you know, what that markup is, it's just insane. But also, I think the idea that drug companies are making so much money on these alternative drugs has to haunt some of us. The fact that, yes, probably cannabis could help a whole lot of people who are using Ambien right now, which we were just, you know, talking about before.
Sure.
Well, you know, here's a plant that you can grow in your own backyard. They're not going to make any money off that. One of the things that I've discussed with Rob Campia of the Marijuana Policy Project is there some way for the government to still get their hands in on this and still get some cash? And in fact, you know, if this were regulated and taxed, there'd be plenty of money for each of the individual states that were willing to do that, and people could still have access to cannabis without having to turn to this underground market, and in particular, without exposure to drugs with worse negative consequences. So a lot of folks who end up saying, well, I have used cocaine, well, where did you get it? I got it from the same person who I purchased cannabis from. Well, if those markets are separated, like they are, say, in the Netherlands, the opportunity to be exposed to cocaine when you're purchasing cannabis disappears. and we'd have a really wonderful chance to essentially have a psychoactive substance that's extremely popular disconnected from one that is extremely dangerous and understandably less popular.
You know, it's my contention that there's a kind of a disconnect where you, how to put it, where people can buy this stuff at, you know, $1,000 a pound, or I don't know, in California it's $3,000 and $4,000 a pound. And yet, as you said, if we taxed it and regulated it and it was locally available, we wouldn't have the black market and the violence, corruption, etc. that is attendant to it.
That's an extremely serious point, because the only violence associated with cannabis really is underground market, turf wars, and things along those lines.
And the excess value of a plant.
Precisely, yeah.
Would it not be possible, I mean, you know, Rush Limbaugh got himself in trouble for using OxyContin, which, as I understand it, is pretty much heroin in a pill, and by virtue of the fact that you can't patent cannabis, you can't patent coca, you can't patent the opium poppy, is the reason they're fighting so hard to keep these drugs illegal?
I think that's got to be at least in the back of some minds, especially of folks who are making a whole lot of money in the drug company domain. It's hard to think of OxyContin being replaced by, say, cannabis, but a whole lot of folks in the pain literature suggest that it could. Well, that's got to horrify these folks who are making 17,000% markup that this might actually happen. There are ready data that suggests that cannabis use could decrease the use of these over-the-counter opiates. Well, if that's your bread and butter and that's your stock bottom line, of course you're going to have to be resistant to that. What I'd like to offer these folks is a share in the taxed cannabis market then. Okay, fine. If your sales are going to go down because we're going to decriminalize cannabis, what can we do to compensate you? What can we do to make this worth your while? Maybe you'd be willing to be in charge of the cannabis. Maybe you guys could take this cannabis market and sort of run it for the state and have it be a productive thing where you could make a small profit and people could still get it, again, without being exposed to drugs with more negative consequences.
I think there's at least a somewhat parallel course going on in Canada, is there not, with the Vancouver Island Compassion Club kind of doing the genetics and, I don't know, steering things along?
They have some splendid data suggesting that different strains have a different impact on different symptoms, so that you may want one set of strains per cannabis for, say, nausea, others to enhance appetite, others to decrease pain. And by doing this investigation, they've really done a whole lot of people a wonderful service, because if you're just going to the street, you can't actually say, hey, what's the cannabinoid that's predominant in this cannabis? People would laugh at you. They just say, here's what I've got for sale. If you want to take it, if not, don't. Valerie Corral, who we've talked about before, the folks who are up at Santa Cruz are also gathering data along these same lines. And the hope is that this could become a much more precise administration of genuine medicine than it is so far. And wow, you see how efficient these drug companies are and how great they are at doing these kinds of tests. If they would take a hold of this, they could just do a splendid job and do a real service for a number of ill folks here in the United States and abroad.
Well, I'm certain that there was some determination, some development of genetics involved with Valley Corral and their crew on the Santa Cruz hillsides. And the same with Mr. Cubby, Steve Cubby. He had a strain that was working for him. It was for his adrenaline cancer.
Exactly.
And then they destroyed his crop and his genetics when they busted him, and he's had to start over again in Canada.
And I think people don't understand that this takes literally years to crossbreed these to get the effects that are desired. And it's not like Steve Cubby has a big chemistry set in the back where he can actually find out which cannabinoid is the one that's creating this effect. It's very much trial and error. Whereas the chemical industry, the drug industry, could really take a hold of this and do a superb job if they only had the impetus. And I think if we could guarantee them a little bit of profit, they would jump right in.
Well, you bet. The profit is the whole thing. It's the, I don't know. I'm not going to get into politics. Okay. Dr. Earlywine, do you have a website where folks could learn more about your work?
They're welcome to come to my website through the University of Southern California, but I think that it would be most interesting for folks if they would just go to the Barnes & Noble website, bn.com. They can get the book right now for $6 off for Christmas, basically.
Wonderful.
And I think that that would be the thing where they can start. I'm also, if any of your listeners want to email me or anything like that, I'm always to answer questions on these topics.
All right. Well, that's great. Now, Dr. Earlywine, I appreciate you coming on with us earlier when we did the Wars of Eternity, the look back around September 11th there. And, you know, it's important, I think, that the folks out there understand that you're not alone. You're not the only scientist or doctor that has looked at this evidence and seen it for what it is. Discuss that before you go.
Sure thing. I mean, there is excellent work by Leslie Iverson, by Lester Grinspoon. Folks are bringing out new things on policy, Mark Kleiman. Basically, a whole set of folks, both in policy, in psychology, and in medicine, saying this is the way we can look at these data and make the most sense of them. And everybody seems to come to the same conclusion. There's no real reason to keep cannabis criminalized. And in fact, financially, it seems to be not worth it. As economists like Jeffrey Moran at Massachusetts has shown, there are literally millions of dollars to be saved by each individual state, and probably easily a billion across the United States if we could just decriminalize, just take away the penalties. Never mind, you know, any concerns about how do we provide or anything like that. Let's just not arrest people for smoking cannabis, and it would be amazing how much money we would save there and that alone. In Australia now, two territories have basically turned it into an idea that you would just get a traffic ticket, essentially, if you were caught with cannabis. And the law enforcement officials there love it. It's much easier to enforce. They don't end up having to waste a whole day taking somebody down, booking them, fingerprinting them, and then have the prosecuting attorney basically say, oh, gee, we're not interested because there wasn't enough cannabis. This way they write a ticket, they confiscate the cannabis, and off they go. And no, it's not necessarily the ideal thing for everybody who's a cannabis activist, but I think it's such a wonderful step in the right direction that it's really just financially the thing that we need to consider most.
Well, Dr. Earlywine, I want to thank you for joining us here on Cultural Baggage, and I think you're absolutely right that once we begin to disprove these lies, more progress will come around.
I'm optimistic.
All right. Thank you, sir.
Sure thing.
Okay. In closing today, I had a couple of things I wanted to tell you. The reports are coming out of Afghanistan now. They have 36 times the amount of heroin being grown over there than they did before we took over the country. And that's really encouraging, isn't it? Now, if you'd like to contact me here at Drug War News at kpft.org. If you want to hear some of our prior shows, go to cultural-baggage.com. And as always, I remind you, because of drug prohibition, you don't know what's in that bag. So please take care of one another. Be sure of what you're doing. And, you know, just be careful. And we'll see you next week. Our guest will be Deborah Small of the Drug Policy Alliance about the upcoming Breaking the Chains conference.
For the Drug Truth Network, and on behalf of my technical producer, Steve Nolan, this is Dean Becker for Cultural Baggage, the unvarnished truth. This show is produced at the Pacifica Studios of KPFT, Houston.